Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster and our big extravagant Marvel movie cinematic universe rewatch thing. That's the official title, right?
Right. I'm making the comic flipping through sound.
You know.
Wait till the third phase, and then it'll be like a 5-minute flick version. And then
exactly.
Cut to Benedict Cumberbatch, cut to another character.
Right. You could like literally go to the bathroom, get some popcorn, come back. And the movie still wouldn't have started by the time that new logo has gone through.
I don't care. I love it all.
I love the original one, just the flick book. That's my favorite one.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm Mike, and today I'm joined by a couple of people from around the Nerd Party Network. Philip from SETI Alpha 3. How's it going, Philip?
Doing well. Also from Time and Space.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Jeez, you know, I'm so far behind. You know, it's one of those things where like Doctor Who is completely foreign to me.
Well,
I mean, and not just because it's British, but also because like I've seen like literally like 3 episodes of that show in my entire life. Oh. So, but of course, Time and Space, and hey, there's one of those Who doctors here in the thingy, right?
Yes, that is, and I will definitely be talking about his use or non-use in that movie.
And today we are also joined by, it feels weird saying that we're joined by, because, you know, in reality, we're joining him. You know, this is his sandbox that we're playing in. Lee from, well, here.
And from Britain as well, so in a way I am closer to Doctor Who than you and Philip.
Geographically speaking, yes.
Exactly. Sure. You know, Stanley, is responsible mostly, you know, in the grand scheme of things for Marvel, but Lee Hutchinson is responsible for...
Yeah, exactly. I've never really thought of it like that.
Yes.
It's a tale of two Lees.
That's right.
If you looked him up in the phone book, we wouldn't be too far apart.
So today we're going to be talking about a couple of Marvel movies, Iron Man 3 and Thor: The Dark World. So let's just kick this off. Iron Man 3. Philip, do you want to give a little rundown of what this movie is?
Sure. Oh, goodness. I don't know if I can give a synopsis off the top of my head. But I think one of the interesting things is, of course, this is the first post-Avengers movie. I guess we can officially call this Phase 2. I don't know. You know, I don't have my nerd book in front of me.
So this is officially Phase 2?
Yeah, so this kicks off Phase 2. This is the first movie to deal with the consequences of the New York invasion. I forget what the exact wording would be. But, so Iron Man 3, you have Tony dealing with that. Can't sleep, tinkering all day. And eventually, he's faced with the terrorist threat of the Mandarin, or at least the U.S. is, I suppose, but the world, really. And he has to deal with not only that threat, but a sort of new threat from a potentially old rival, AIM, which all Marvel fans tingled when they saw that little AIM come up, who have read the comic books. And we eventually have to deal with the showdown, especially with now War Machine becoming American Patriot. That is not what he's called. Anyway, his rebranding.
Is it Iron Patriot?
Iron Patriot. Yeah, Patriot. That, something ridiculous like that. And so Brody gets taken over. And all these wonderful things with the culmination of Pepper being kidnapped and Iron Man, Tony Stark, having to fight. And, of course, this is sort of... What happens in Iron Man 3 is typically what happens in a sequel, in other words, the second movie, and that is the loss of the power suit, whatever, and can you recover without it? Because after the attack on his home, Tony Stark is left in the middle of Nowheresville, which I'm sure they don't appreciate being called that, and must fashion his rescue without his trusty suit. And most technology, he has to become the mechanic. So there's lots more to the movie, but that's sort of the rough part. And I will just briefly say before I give the other chance to talk is that I think Iron Man 1 would have to be my favorite of the trilogy, but I think 3 is very, very close to Iron Man 1. And then 2 is last.
What about you, Lee? Where do you rank this in the Iron Man?
Yeah, I'd probably rank this as the second best one, but I think they're quite close at the top. And then the second one, sadly, Sam Rockwell aside, is all the way at the back.
Yeah, I would say that my rankings are very similar there. It's weird because, like, you look at the first Iron Man and it's like, well, this holds up as one of the very best of all of the Marvel movies. And, you know, sort of like the skill of craftsmanship at play is top-notch. But I love how sort of punk Iron Man 3 is, you know? Like, this is the movie where I guess you could kind of say Avengers, but whatever, not really. But to me, this is like the first of the cinematic universe, which was kind of like quote-unquote auteur-driven or whatever, you know, where they actually got, like, a writer-director to come in and sort of, like, craft this thing and make it, you know, their own and stuff. And I think that the results are something weird and different and cool in a way that none of the Marvel movies really had been up until this point, you know? I mean, this may not be the best of the early Marvel movies, but I do think it's the most unique, and because of that, it's certainly one of my favorites, you know?
Yeah, and I think that with Iron Man 3, you know, I think Tony Stark in Iron Man 3 and Robert Downey Jr., he sort of was the flagship, for lack of a better word, of the Marvel Universe. You know, I never count Avengers when I'm talking about sort of these movies, so that aside. But, you know, but the third movie, you know, can always be dangerous territory. You know, are we bank, you know, did we need an Iron Man 3? You know, some might ask. But I think it avoids maybe some pitfalls that the trilogies can sometimes come to, because of course this isn't the end. I guess that helps, right? You know, so you don't have to be like, and it's over, because no, you know, how many more movies have followed since? But it is interesting that I think his Tony Stark's emotional story has more meaning than the second one, even though there's also an emotional story there. So just very quickly, Iron Man 2, it was the I think I'm dying, so of course I push everyone away and have a raging party because I'm a narcissistic person, blah, blah, blah. And that was okay. It seems made up. But Iron Man 3, this is PTSD is a little far, I think. But the dealing with, you know, the nuclear bomb in space and death and all that from the New York invasion and Avengers, I think that has a little bit more something I can grab onto Tony Stark's struggle and identity and all that stuff a little bit more than I did with the two.
Yeah, I like the... When I was watching the trailers, I was immediately hooked into kind of the drama aspect that they seem to be selling with Iron Man 3, that you kind of see in all the previous ones. It's like big action adventure movies, but with Iron Man 3 you thought, oh, they're going to get quite deep here and like really kind of go for it. And I wish they'd maybe ran with that a little bit further. It does seem to be sort of kind of take up maybe the first 20-30 minutes and then it sort of gets jettisoned out for another plot. But I did really like that, and I kind of totally agree with what Mike said, that this is the first time you watch a Marvel movie, and you watch the first wave movies, and you can pick up all these little kind of bits and pieces of all the directors and writers' involvement. But this like feels like a proper Shane Black movie where he's playing in that Marvel kind of sandbox. I think that's really exciting, and I think that's something you see a lot more of in Marvel Phase 2 with people like him and then James Gunn and the Russo brothers.
I thought it was, and you guys know names and backgrounds and stuff more than I do. I just be like, the guy, and you'll tell me everything. But the bad henchman guy, I don't know, he's the hitman, right, from that movie? But anyway.
Which guy? The Guy Pierce? Is that?
No, his bodyguard. The one.
Oh, John Favreau.
No.
Happy.
No, the bad guy's henchman. Basically the one who, you know, Happy is looking at for his badge.
Oh, James Badge Dale, I think is his name.
Yes. 24's Chase.
Yeah. There you go, yeah. Anyway. But anyway, so like he seems, you know, an action, like you could take him out in the movie, would still work. But it seems like we want him because we know he can do some cool action scenes, and that'll be awesome. And so it's like, and that's not a complaint. It's just sort of like, I often see where things are just added because, yeah, we want the just boom, boom, smack, smack stuff. And that's fine. Though I do think this does fall into the superhero CGI Act 3 Mesopotamia that sometimes can happen in superhero movies. I don't think it's crazy, but it kind of reminds me of like Wonder Woman and other ones where it's just like, and CGI Act 3. And
I guess I can see that, but to me, I don't know. I think that this one works better than most because, and this is a problem which I think a lot of superhero movies suffer from, like including the first Iron Man, where it's like, and now we're going to have the battle between our hero and the super big bad guy, right? And it's like, okay, this is just going to be like two people punching each other for like 10 minutes. And, you know, here, I mean, at least it was so like visually dynamic with all the, you know, hundreds of suits flying all over the place and everything like that. And I thought that that was pretty cool. It's really interesting. I mean, like getting back to the whole like Shane Black thing and action movie tropes or whatever, and all this stuff, you know, Shane Black kind of like invented like the modern action movie formula with all of his work in the 80s as a writer on things like Lethal Weapon and all that stuff. And then he just kind of dropped off the face of the earth for like 10 years before making a comeback with sort of like indie action movies like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And, you know, his involvement with Iron Man 3 is like so kind of like cool and cyclical and everything because I mean, as the story goes, you know, Robert Downey Jr. was kind of a wild card in terms of reliability when it comes to massive motion pictures. And, you know, his quote-unquote comeback was with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which Black wrote and directed. And he was the one who told the studio, like, don't worry, you can count on Downey, you know? And that's why they cast him in Iron Man. So now, three movies down the road, when Robert Downey Jr. is the king of Marvel and can basically dictate terms, he's like, now it's time for Shane Black to come in, you know, return in the favor. And it's pretty great because now I think more than anything, because of Iron Man 3, Shane Black is again making, you know, a bunch of, he's doing the new Predator movie and everything like that. So I think that that's pretty cool. But I mean, like you're saying, Lee, it totally is a Shane Black movie. You look at Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, this feels like the Marvel Cinematic Universe version of that, you know? And as far as like the action and everything is concerned, or the way that you structure like an action movie, obviously this guy, you know, he kind of wrote the book on it, and it's insane. Like I read this analysis of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, where they talk about how like it takes place over the span of like 3 days or something like that, or 4 days, I guess, and each day like represents a different act in the you know, sort of like prototypical action movie structure and everything like that. This dude is like top notch, super genius when it comes to constructing action movies, and I think it. Even if you don't like sit and like analyze it here, I think you feel it because it doesn't feel like, okay, and now we're going into this part of the movie, even though, because he knows all the parts of the movies and how to like fully integrate them. And I don't know. I think that's one of the reasons why this movie works so well. I don't know. That is, yeah, Set at Christmas.
And the fact that it's got the Shane Black touch of it, Set at Christmas Time as well. That I remembered when Shane Black was announced, it was like, oh, of course, it makes perfect sense because of that connection with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I think is a modern masterpiece personally. So I thought, like, yeah, I was really excited to get him in. And, you know, as you say, he is the kind of, he's kickstarted so many great action movies. And I think in this movie in particular, I think the scene where, I think, was it Air Force One, where that explodes and Iron Man starts kind of catching all the journalists as they're falling to their peril, I think that's a fantastic scene, and in particular looks amazing in IMAX. It's definitely one of my favorite Marvel action moments personally.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of beats that work with the action you know, scenes that are, you know, they're just more than that, I think, but that work. But then, you know, you have, like, the part with the kid. I'm sure that that's not the what we should call it, but the part with the kid, which my wife, like, she liked the kid. It works, you know, it's cliche, but she's like, hey, the kid, he's cute. It works. So, you know, and then you just have these little sort of character moments and then action moments. And I'm sure maybe it is formulaic once you sort of do the outline, but I think it works in a way of making sure everything's there. So it's not just globs of action or globs of character pieces, and it does sort of make the pacing and the beats work.
Yeah, the character stuff is awesome, and it's irreverent. You know, like, I think the reason why the stuff with the kid works is because it's not like, oh, look at the cute kid. I mean, it's basically Tony Stark, you know, making fun of a 10-year-old kid. And, you know, that's comedy gold right there. So, you know, and it is not something that you would expect to see in a movie like this, you know, which I think is one of the things which makes it cool.
Yeah,
and the kid returns and the nice guys as well, and like the opening scene as well. So it kind of, Shane Black loves kind of reuniting with people from movies, it seems.
Yeah,
because so, I have to admit, from a, like, on paper, Iron Man and Tony Stark are not my favorite. You know, I mean, like, to be the stereotypical person, I'm a Captain America, I'm not an Iron Man, you know. And so coming back to an Iron Man movie, I'm like, okay, I mean, Robert Downey and Tony Stark alone, I don't know, but I think from that perspective, watching Iron Man 3, it still is a great movie.
So it's
obviously one of the, it seems that one of the more controversial things is, like, we talked about, like, the characters, is obviously the Mandarin that, yeah, you know, like, people seem to really kind of kick off about that, where I don't know about yous, but I kind of greet it with a bit of a, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, well, I guess my only thing, I mean, and, you know, we could get into the cinematic politics of everything. Not that there's anything wrong with getting into the cinematic politics of everything. But I think with the Mandarin, I think Ben Kingsley works for the reveal, not for the front end. And so I guess it works, you know, because of, you know, like, I mean, look, this is a spoiler, right? We don't care. You know, when he's like, okay, out of work, you know, whatever, British actor. Okay, well, obviously, Ben Kingsley is great. But, like, the Mandarin, okay, like, I don't know. I don't know how you take off the Scooby mask for it to be someone else, maybe, you know, and then it's revealed to be Ben Kingsley. I don't know, but anyway.
I personally don't know, but maybe for me, but, like, I remember those Iron Man 3 trailers were on all the time, in particular, in the particular IMAX. I remember just sitting in the cinema, and it was just that chilling Ben Kingsley, you'll never see me coming. And you were like, ooh, like, it's like these kind of, like, big screen terrorist threatening kidnap videos. And you're like, ooh, this seems like pricks. And, like, admittedly, it was like the time, I was like, oh, I really wish they'd pushed on with this being a kind of the sinister kind of Mandarin. But, like, I thought those, like, he was brilliant as the Mandarin and also as a kind of Cockney actor, out of work actor.
I don't know, part of it was, like, seeing those trailers and everything. And this is one of the reasons why I was, you know, obviously, you know, the marketing, and God, I, you know, even though that was only just a few years ago, I can't imagine them even trying to do that today, because the backlash would be insane leading up to this movie, I think. But, like, I remember thinking, like, okay, they cast Ben Kingsley as the Mandarin. That's a little weird. Like, you know, I mean, talk about whitewashing, right? You know, and I remember there being, like, mild criticism of that, and I was like, this is, and I remember seeing the trailers and thinking, like, this dude won an Oscar. This dude was in Schindler's List, and look at what he has to do for
Gandhi,
a paycheck.
For goodness sakes.
You know, yeah, it's just like, it's
brilliant,
like,
in House of Sand and Fog as well.
Yeah, he's you know, like, one of the greatest, you know, living
actors.
He was
the vice president in Dave. I mean, come on, you can list everything
Yeah, and then, you know, here he is, like, doing this, like, super over the top, like, terrorist stuff, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. It's ridiculous what this guy has to resort to for a paycheck. And then, you know, like, watching the movie, you know, whatever, I guess I was into it or whatever. But then when you do have the reveal, I was just completely blown away by that. And I was like, this is absolute brilliance. This is 100% genius. And, you know, they played the long game, like, through the trailers and everything. This is a case where the marketing enhanced it, because, you know, everyone had it in their mind, like, this guy is the Mandarin in the traditional sense. And then they just pull the rug out from under us. And I just thought this was great. And I know that there were a lot of comic book fans who were like, they messed up the Mandarin. He's one of the best characters. And to me, like, I could not care less about the Mandarin. You know, I'm just like, whatever. There's no way that whatever the Mandarin's origin story is or whatever is better or more appropriate for these movies than what they did in this. And I just thought it was absolute genius what they did, and Kingsley's performance was insanely good, you know.
Yeah. I can't remember if it was in the special features or something, but you have like a putting on a stage play in prison, and does he not encounter the real life Mandarin then or something? Like, it's been a wee while since I've deep dived into the special features, but I'm sure there's something like that where it's like, like, you thought the Mandarin wasn't real, well actually he is, so kind of this makes up for it if you're an annoyed fanboy, some special feature or something. I think I remember there being a bit of fuss about that, but I definitely need to revisit that one.
Well, I just like the meta commentary. I mean, even if it's unintentional, that, you know, we're like, oh, you know, that, you know, whitewashing and da da da, and like, no, in the movie he is a British actor. In the movie, they thought he was Middle Eastern, so that's on you people that you thought he was, because he's clearly a British actor in the character as the character. And so right. It's like, is it our fault or is it your fault for thinking that he could be the Mandarin? So.
And there was also the thing where, you know, people were critical. I mean, there were people who were critical of them even using the character of the Mandarin, because it's like, this is playing on some pretty weird Asian stereotypes and stuff like that, which we're trying to get away from. And it's like, oh, yeah, well, we're going to talk about that, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's awesome. As far as that short is concerned, that was like one of those Marvel, I think it was the last Marvel one-shot that they did. It was on the Thor Dark World disc. It was called All Hail the King, I think. It was written and directed by Drew Pearce, who co-wrote Iron Man 3, and it's pretty awesome. And yeah, it's on that Thor Dark World disc. So unless you guys have any
segue,
let's head on over. You know, change the disc out of the PS4 and take a look at Thor: The Dark World, which is the next film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This one directed by Alan Taylor, almost directed by Wonder Woman's Patty Jenkins, but you know. Whatever, Marvel kind of dropped the ball on that one. And, yeah. Lee, do you want to give a synopsis of The Dark World?
We'll do a short and sweet one because, Jane Foster gets cursed with a powerful entity known as the Aether. And Thor is heralded of the cosmic event known as the Convergence and the genocide of the Dark Elves. So, Doctor Who finally makes his entrance into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Not the first Doctor Who to play a role in this large universe. So we have that. Loki is back. Thor is back, and Jane Foster is back. So yes, that's the excitement of Thor 2.
Yeah. So Philip, what did you think about this one?
Yeah, I watched. Yeah, I've been watching all these movies as I've done the rewatch this year or last year too, I suppose. But anyway, this rewatch of getting ready for Infinity Countdown, I watched them with my wife, and so her comment was when we finished Thor 2 was like, you know, she said something like, every time I sit down and watch these, I think I'm not going to like it, but then I do. And to myself, I'm like, really, even with Thor 2? But she enjoyed Thor 2. I mean, I don't hate it. I know that's faint praise, right? But I guess it's maybe what we kind of talked about a little bit with Iron Man 3, of how they successfully did the action movie, but not too much, whereas I think with Thor 2, it's kind of like action movie fantasy. I don't know, this is my opinion, obviously. Action movie fantasy, and it's kind of like not much to it. I mean, there's still great moments, so it's not a bad movie, or even a bad Marvel movie, though I suppose maybe you can call it a bad Marvel movie, given the high stakes or what we seem to expect. But, I mean, it's no Incredible Hulk, you know. But anyway, it's you know, if you're making your list, it's at the bottom for me. But, you know, I watched it again and would watch it again if I had to.
What about you, Lee?
Yeah,
what did you think about,
I've only ever maybe watched this a handful of times. I went to see it kind of midnight release, and then yeah, I kind of watched it, and I'm a big fan of the first Thor movie. I really enjoyed that, And with this one, I thought at the beginning, you know, there's Thor out kind of cocky, saving the, you know, all these different realms. But I just always, I mean, I love Natalie Portman, but I've never particularly enjoyed her in these movies. You know, in the first one, yeah, I thought she was fine. But this one I thought was a real struggle. Just I have no interest in their love relationship or plot. And the fact that she's in peril does nothing much for me either. So it was just always sort of a bit of a slog that she really kind of has kind of front and center of this. I like Christopher Eccleston. I think he's a really good, intense actor. I mean, as a villain, he's brilliant in 28 Days Later. So the idea of him coming into the Marvel Cinematic Universe got me quite excited. But then in reality, I found him to be quite a boring, bland character. Elves are never an intimidating force. I think I like the location's use in London. Greenwich is one of my favourite places to walk around in London, and the Royal Naval College, which gets trashed towards the end of the movie, is a place I like to go. So I like seeing those places I recognise on the big screen, but otherwise it's quite a forgettable movie. I like the big dog. I guess that's it. What about you, Mike?
You know, it's weird. Like, I don't think that Marvel has made a bad movie yet, which is kind of impressive, considering how far in we are now, 10 years, and they still haven't made a bad movie. And, you know, I thought for sure that the first one would be Guardians of the Galaxy, but yeah, that didn't exactly turn out that way. But yeah, you know, with this one, I definitely think it is, like you're saying, one of the lesser movies. I'd probably put it like third from the bottom or something like that. But it's
okay, Mike. I have to ask. Then yeah. What are your bottoms?
Well, number I think probably the worst would be the first Thor movie, and then really? Actually okay. this would probably be number two. You know, because I'd put Hulk ahead of this, and I'd put the first Captain America ahead of this. So yeah.
Okay. Continue.
Yeah, this would be number two.
I always love Mike List. That's all I'm going to say.
there's certainly, like, if we're doing like phases of quality, this is in phase three for sure. So and it's because it is, like you're saying, like paint by numbers, you know, kind of standard action fare, and but even within that, I think it's like really well done. Like, I was watching it yesterday, and the whole time I kept on thinking, like, what I really want to be watching is this disc which I picked up a couple days ago, Thor Ragnarok. You know? But instead, I'm sitting here watching Dark World, and you know, it was just like I wasn't really into it at all. But there were certainly moments, like especially like in the action sequences and stuff, where I was like, wow, this is really well done. You know, it's well constructed on a story level and everything like that. But you know, and it's very visceral and stuff. But it really does kind of feel disposable in a lot of ways. And you know, it's weird. It took them three movies, but they finally hacked the Thor Gibson, you know, with Ragnarok, and now I feel like if they would have done that first, everything that we would have seen prior to that would have been completely different. But maybe we wouldn't even get to that point were it not for the first two. So
because I think it does have a very televisual feel, and I think that maybe comes from kind of the rushed nature of it. That obviously kind of touched on it. Kathy Jenkins was the original director of this. I think Natalie Portman was unhappy that when she left the project, and I think with Alan Taylor coming on, I think his background was like Game of Thrones, so it seemed like a kind of made sense as a fit. But I think when you watch this, you can tell it sort of had a rushed kind of production time, and this was probably a director that didn't really have much in the way that he could really influence the picture, like say Shane Black did, and kind of the Russos and James Gunn that are coming up next. So I think with this, he's probably working to that kind of television budget. You know, here's your locations, right, go point, shoot. And there maybe wasn't that period of time to make it something kind of perhaps a bit unique that say Taiki Waititi was able to do, and I think Kenneth Branagh did, especially with the first one.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We talked earlier about Ben Kingsley, or I suppose Sir Ben Kingsley. But Chris Eccleston, like you said, Lee, I mean, he always strikes me as being an actor's actor in both good ways and bad ways. Like, he's an actor. And so this is definitely a paycheck for him. I mean, in other words, like, I'm surprised that he took it because I know, or I think I know, I don't pretend to know the man, but I think I know how temperamental might not be the right word, but, you know, he has a craft and he likes to use it, but, like, he's just thrown under CGI. Did he even need to show up? Like, you know, here's my face mold, here's your paycheck, bye. You know, like, I don't know what, because I know he's great. He's obviously theater and television, like, he can do it all, but I don't think he brings anything to this role that is Chris Eccleston, and so I feel like he's woefully wasted. Idris Elba. Because I think they got him early, at least. I know he's probably getting far in the UK, but at least in America with Thor 1, so he's sort of, you know, tertiary character Idris. And that, but at this point, I'm like, dude, you're so wasting him in this movie again. Because you have all these great actors, of course. I mean, you know, for God's sake, Sir Anthony Hopkins. But anyway, but of course, he's hamming it up as always, as Odin. But anyway, but you have all these sort of great actors, but not doing a lot with all these great actors. And so I think there was potential there. And maybe, you know, having not seen Ragnarok, la, 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 I'm sure there's parts where hopefully they maybe start using people because they have all these other actors I know in that movie as well. But a lot of potential in Thor 2, but nothing to do with it.
Yeah, not getting into any specifics about Ragnarok, but I feel like Ragnarok in a lot of ways gave these actors a chance to sort of like blow off steam after doing these. Like, it's almost like, okay, we know that we hired you to be a name in this, you know, action movie franchise where you're really not doing much at all. But now at least you can have a little fun and play around with this a bit. You know, I get that impression from Ragnarok, but you're right. It is crazy. It is crazy seeing these names. I mean, I always think about that whenever I'm watching like a Transformers movie, and I'm like, wow, there's Francis McDormand and John Malkovich and John Turturro. It's like a Coen Brothers movie, literally. You know, like how? But then you think about it, and you're like, well, they've got the best cinematographers and the best editors and the best production designers and everything. And it's like when you have $200 million to make these things, you are going to hire the best craftsmen in the business, right? And that includes actors. So why wouldn't you get Anthony Hopkins for your, you know, crazy little comic book movie? And he's, you know, certainly capable and good at it and everything. And yeah, it's
but
fine.
I think with
you know,
Anthony Hopkins, I think it, like, I know you're not a fan of the first Thor, but for me, I really like what Kenneth Branagh kind of brought to it. That I think with him and Taiki Waititi, they all brought their own kind of take on the Thor character. And I think with his, that this sort of Shakespearean kind of world and realm, and I think like Anthony Hopkins makes perfect sense for that type of universe. And I think, yeah, less so with kind of two, because it just doesn't seem to have much of a vision of how to use these characters. And when you think of, I think like the kind of humorous Thor that we kind of especially get in number three, you see that in sort of that first Avengers movie. And I think there was definitely kind of, you know, you could see that he was a good comic actor from those movies. And then, you know, obviously Ghostbusters. And I think with Kenneth Branagh, he saw Anthony Hopkins and he saw him fit into that universe. And obviously, if he had continued, maybe Anthony Hopkins would have continued to kind of flourish in that role. But naturally, he kind of exited stage left after the first one.
Because I think with even Renee Russo, I mean, you know, not the biggest name in the world, but, you know, she's got chops, she's done stuff, and then, all right, we're going to kill her off. I mean, because she gets a little, that's the rule, right? When you die, you get a little bit more character moment, that, and then that's it, though. So it's like, well, that's sad, you know, that she, because she was basically background for Thor 1, sadly, right? But, you know, so she gets a few seconds of, you know, showing she can kick some butt as Odin's wife, you know, as queen of Asgard. And so, but then it's like, bye. And so, yeah.
But that's the other thing. Like, I guess they have a plan, and whatever it is, it's working.
Uh-oh, because uh-oh, we're doing the discovery thing.
Tons of million dollars. Yeah, but, like, when they're like, okay, and now Thor 2 is next, right? I'm like, it seems kind of weird that they're doing a Thor 2, because did anyone go to see Thor 1? Like, is the world, like, clamoring for a Thor 2? And then when they were like, we're doing Thor 3, I was like, they're really, you know, staying the course on this. Like, the last movie I want to see is Thor 3. You know what I mean? And, like, I feel like... I get the impression that these are not, like, planned trilogies or whatever. Maybe they are. Maybe they plan to do, like, three movies each. Although now, I think after Ragnarok... I mean, I think a lot of people see Ragnarok as Thor 1, to be honest, you know, and they'll get more. But like, with, you know, Thor 2 or whatever, like, yeah, they're setting things up. Like, there's the whole thing where, like, now Loki's on the throne, and you're like, oh, my God, you know. And I think there's some things where they're just like, you know, I mean, like, having seen Ragnarok, like, watching this and seeing the end of it, I'm like... There were numerous things where I was like, they really just kind of throw that away, don't they? They just kind of ignore that, and that thing goes away, and they don't really care. And so doing things like killing off, you know, Anthony Hopkins and this or whatever, I see it as perfectly fine, because I don't really think that they were thinking like, well, we need to save him for the next one, because they didn't even necessarily know that there would be a next one. In to some degree, which I guess that's how you should do it, right? You know, put your best foot forward all the time, and you know, make the best movie you possibly can. Don't save anything for next time, because there might not be a next time.
I suppose the difficulty is when you've got like these franchises where it's like you've got 6 movie deals, 7 movie deals, 9 movie deals, and it's right, we've kind of, we could kill you off, it would be best for the story, but we've still got you up our sleeve for the next 6 movies, or maybe we want to use you in Infinity War, or maybe we'd actually want to move you to Doctor Strange or something like that. So I think there's always a bit of a challenge with these movies, you know, that does restrict them somewhat with who they can kind of get rid of, I guess.
Or even the Coulson rule will just give you a TV series.
Yeah,
because there's actually, I mean, not a lot, but I remember, it's been a while since I've watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but it was interesting as it was airing where they had to react, well, they don't have to, but they have to. They have to react to all the movies. You know, and so, you know, like I remember, you know, the Thor 2, you know, all right, we have to do our reaction episode to Thor 2. And, you know, Lady Sith, I think, cameoed in an episode or two of Agents.
That was the big first season crossover, wasn't it? It's like, there's a Thor cameo, and it's like, oh, who's it going to be? It's this person. And then it's like, okay, I won't watch. I'll catch up at some point.
One thing I noticed in this movie, and I don't know if, because y'all are usually more detailed oriented than me, but I noticed it watching it going, like, that's clearly not the same actor. And that is Zachary Levi.
Yes.
Played that character. I don't remember the character's name. In this movie, and not in Thor 1, who was played by, you know names, I don't. In Thor 1. But then my wife was wikiing it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think what she told me was Zachary was initially going to be cast in Thor 1 as that character, but then conflict, and then the character who was had a conflict in Thor 2, so they're like, yeah, let's go back to the well and do Zach in the first place.
I suppose that's kind of quite consistent with Marvel movies. You think of the cast change with War Machine, like both auditioned for the movie, you know, Eric, in terms of Eric Bana, Edward Norton and Mark Ruffalo. Like, originally they wanted Mark Ruffalo, they got Edward Norton, then when they realized Edward Norton was challenging, they were like, get Mark Ruffalo, get a nice, cool, relaxed guy. So it's quite consistent, I suppose, with this universe of, right, who was our number two pick, or who was unavailable, and then they just kind of go with it. It's quite good that way. I like it.
Yeah, word on the street is they're notoriously cheap, and that's why a lot of these people don't come back too, you know, they just don't want to pay them. So, yeah,
like, that was a bit, I suppose, cool. That kind of like ties in with Marvel 3. I think there's some really good articles about the kind of the production of the first phase, where, like, even at some of the premiere parties, it was like quite a small buffet you would get, and there wasn't much in the way of that extra cash really to kind of throw around, that you would say you get like a increase on your deal, but like they were all quite frugal. And I think even though they, like, say Avengers made $1 billion, then Iron Man 3 made $1 billion, like the first kind of bunch of movies, they were popular, but they weren't setting sort of the box office alight, perhaps. And like, it was the start of a brand new studio, they had this big loans out. I can sort of understand their frugal nature, which now that they're sort of been liberated by Disney, and then kind of Kevin Feige's now sort of kind of seized control, I think there's a lot more money to play around with. You can go, right, I want, you know, Robert Downey Jr. in Captain America Civil War, right, we need to pay him $30 million or something like that. Right, here you go. Whereas before they would have been like, nah, just recast. I think that would have been the case.
I think there was a decent craft table on Black Panther set this time. I'm just going to guess.
And they did the thing early on. I mean, you had, yeah, Robert Downey Jr. in the first one, but like the other like leads were not like huge super name, you know? I mean, I don't think anyone knew who Chris Hemsworth was at the time. His big movie, well, not even really. I was going to say it was Cabin in the Woods, but that it wasn't even out yet because it got shelved for
post-Thor reveal, right? Or release.
Was it not like Joss Whedon sort of endorsed Chris Hemsworth for the role? Because I think obviously Cabin in the Woods had been filmed and completed, and I think he had put in a good word of mouth for Hemsworth.
Yeah.
Now, when was, because I guess y'all know this, when did we go from Marvel to Marvel Studios? Like, what movie was the first?
Well, Marvel Studios officially kicked off with, like, these movies, so with Iron Man. But they had a distribution deal with Paramount, which went, like, Disney bought them sort of just before Avengers came out. So Disney have had it since then, but Paramount had the distribution deal. So you'll see the Paramount logo in Iron Man 3, and then it's never to be seen from again. That's when you get your Marvel Flick logo exclusively. so that's kind of the timeline of it all, that they took out this big bank loan to really make Iron Man and then Incredible Hulk 2 months later. So like that was sort of the timeline of these movies, really.
And even Hulk was distributed by Universal because of the deals and everything like that. And, you know, whatever the deal is exactly, but that's why...
It's sort of the same as, like, the one that we get with sort of Spider-Man Homecoming to an extent. A bit like they own the rights, but, like, it's a bit more kind of messy than that. So that's why whenever you see these Marvel movies, you know, with new sleeves or distributed again, it's, like, very less likely you won't see it with, like, the Marvel kind of packaging. It's sort of a Universal movie. It's kind of the new hope of the franchise, you know, in a slight way.
Right. Hulk wasn't as bad as Spider-Man in that, like, Sony just owns Spider-Man flat out. But with Hulk, like, Marvel was producing the movies, but Universal has the right to distribute them. And that's, I guess that holds true. That's why we haven't seen another Hulk movie, because Disney's like, we're going to make a movie for Universal to release? Nah. You know? Yeah,
that's another thing my wife, as we watch, she's like, and she'll, you know, because she's not, you know, as into it as I am, or, you know, she's not a nerdy nerd. And so she'll be like, does Hulk have his own movie? I'm like, no. Or, you know, Mark Ruffalo is who she's asking. And I'm like, well, and he's in Ragnarok, which we both haven't seen yet, obviously. So I'm like, you know, they kind of share a movie or, you know, whatever, but no, he doesn't get it. So she was disappointed that there's not a Hulk movie. So maybe, who knows, in the future, Mark Ruffalo isn't, you know, aged, I'm sure.
I would kind of class Thor 3 as very much a buddy cop movie. Well, but, you know, by the ring, sort of between the two. So if you're looking for a Thor movie, Thor and Hulk movie, then you've kind of got that coming up.
Marvel matchup. And so, you know, also for the nerdy nerds, since this is lead up to Infinity with Thor 2, we get our second Infinity Gem. We have the I'm not good with names. We have the Tesseract, which is now at this point still located in Asgard, but at the it's not post credits, but I guess what do you call pre-credits?
Pre-credits.
Yeah, seeing you get the Asgardians taking the stuff, red stuff, I'm sure there's a name for it, to the Collector. And so there was our second Infinity Gem at this point in the Avengers Marvel universe.
And I think it was that credit cookie where I was like, you know, where you see like the pink lady and you see Benicio del Toro.
You're like for a credit scene? Really? What was y'all? Because I know, you know, Mike, what was your reaction with Benicio del Toro gets 5 seconds? You're like, no, what's happening?
I mean, but see, here's the thing, right? Like, I don't know when you guys saw. Did you guys see the first Iron Man in the theater?
Yeah, I did.
I can't remember.
Okay, because like I remember watching that movie. And, you know, watching through the credits, and it's weird because, like, I knew that there was something at the credits, and then, like, I stopped watching it, you know, like, I went to do other stuff because I was at work, and then my coworker was like, oh, what about that thing at the end credits? And I'm like, oh, crap, I forgot. And I ran back in the theater, you know, to watch, and that is, like, the best credit cookie in the history of movies. It's just like, oh my god, because you're expanding the universe exponentially at that point, you know, to the point where people are doing podcasts about how all these movies connected. Like, that did not happen in comic book movies. And you know, it got to the point very, very quickly where, like with the second one, where it's like, okay, but now we know that Guardians of the Galaxy is in production or whatever. So, yes, oh, look, there's Benicio del Toro for, you know, 2 seconds, and what's going on here? It's like, well, we know what's going on here. Oh, we know that Guardians of the Galaxy is coming out in, you know, 3 months or whatever it is. And so that was always kind of like a bump, or that still to this day is kind of a bummer for me. Like, the credit cookies now, I mean, like, I won't say what happens in them, but, you know, with Black Panther, like, there's a couple of credit cookies, and I'm just like, Yeah. And that's kind of how I feel with, like, all of them. There are no more big reveals because, you know, Variety has already spoiled them. You know what I mean?
Well, and, I mean, there's the Spider-Man one, so.
The Spider-Man one?
After Homecoming, after credits one, where it's just Chris Evans telling you to.
Oh, that is
that. See, that's good, and that's pretty much, you know, like Iron Man 3 with Hulk, you know, nodding off and not listening to, you know, Robert Downey Jr.'s story. You know, things like that are great, you know, and that's really kind of what they need to start doing now. You know, no more like big reveals of what's coming next, but because everything's already been spoiled. But, you know, when I saw that though, when I saw that first credit cookie with the Guardian, I was like, this looks absolutely ridiculous. This is so, like, and I know nothing about Guardians of the Galaxy.
I don't think, like, anyone did.
No, I just knew. Right.
For me, there were no diehard comic book Guardians. Maybe there were, but, like, all five of,
like,
them.
You for know. Me, I was quite excited by it because, like, I was a James Gunn fan. I thought Slither Super is a very underrated superhero movie. So the idea of, like, a James Gunn superhero movie, like, in space was quite exciting. So to even get a kind of glimpse of that, where, like, these pink and green creatures, you're like, oh, it's kind of got that Star Trek vibe. And Benicio del Toro, it was like, ooh, this is the first hint of something, like, I'm excited for, but I have no idea what to expect or what it's going to be.
Yeah, it was the opposite for me. I was just like, this looks super duper cheesy. You know, a raccoon and a tree. Like, what?
Why? Another Doctor Who person. You know, it just is crazy.
Who's the Doctor Who person?
Amy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Karen Gillum.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's and a Star Trek person.
Oh, yeah, so he's out on
it. Uhura.
So, yeah, yeah. I don't know.
But that's the next episode, guys.
That's the next one. That's the next one. Spoilers. That's our little credit cookie here.
So quickly, Stan Lee cameos.
Oh yeah.
Crazy person in the Thor 2 in the facility, mental facility. With Dr. Zelvig, I believe he was.
Oh yes. Thor, I was thinking Iron Man 3. Yeah.
No, yeah, but I couldn't remember Iron Man. That's why I did Thor 2 first. So Iron Man 3. I don't remember.
Yeah, what did he do in Iron Man 3? I forget.
My mind's gone blank.
Oh, well.
But look it up, folks. It happened.
I'm sure there'll be a super cut on YouTube you can flick through or bookmark.
Mm-hmm. For sure. All right. So, Philip, where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. They can tweet me all their favorite Thor 2 moments and remind me while it's still good. That on Twitter at NC Public Servant. And as we said, you can listen to me each and every week talking Star Trek on City Alpha 3 and Doctor Who on Time and Space with my wonderful wife.
Excellent. Lee, Where can people find you when you're not here?
You can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo. You can find me on Filibuster most week. I have interviewed a Doctor Who, so I have that. You can tune in there.
And you can find me right here on the Nerd Party doing a show called Great Shot Kid, where we look at, we don't even really know what we're doing anymore. We're just talking about whatever we want to, but, you know, people who make Star Wars and sort of an expansion of that sort of idea to other things. And you can also find me on a brand new podcast called Film Damage, which is a look at movies from the perspective of the booth. Just head on over to filmdamagepod.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, Lee, thank you very much for having us here on this show and putting this whole thing together.
In the Lee universe.
Indeed.
Yeah. You're like the Kevin Feige of the nerd party.
I know, I've not even provided a craft table for you today, so I can only apologize. And I've made you all get up really early to cater for me as well. So
yeah, but this is phase two.
Exactly.
We know there's not a lot of money, but like, dude, when they start doing, you know, phase three, we know they're going to get extra whenever they want to get up. Great food, full English breakfast.
Wait until I get $1 billion in ad revenue for this episode, then we'll see the wealth going with that one.
So until next time, Excelsior.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.